This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs here on Cliff Central. My name is Gareth Armstrong. It's great to be with you. Luby, that was a lovely smile that you just shot at me.
It's so good to be back. It's so good to be back in this space, in this company, in the energy.
So,
are you happy that I'm back?
It's good to have you back. Yeah. Well, it's felt like it's been quite a long time since we shared the studio together.
It has, but a lot of wonderful things are happening out there. I think there's a real great movement for people just to do good and to do better and make the world a better place. And especially being an entrepreneur, I think the world needs more people to come alive and just do what they love and try to make the world a better place.
Well, that's what I so appreciate about you specifically, is because what you try and do on an active, ongoing basis is balance the two. So you're always doing something good. And if people follow you on Twitter or Facebook, social media somewhere, they're going to see lots of pictures with you with kids and doing a whole bunch of good stuff.
The ultimate question being, what is your why?
Yeah, and we heard a great way of asking this the other day, which was, if you go and you write down your why, what do you think your why is, and it doesn't make you cry, then it's not really your why. So, Andy, have you heard that before?
Do you like that? What do you think?
This is all from the Simon Sinek, Start With Why.
Start With Why, but they took it a step further, which was...
Why must make you cry.
exactly.
Yeah, we've actually done a ton of work on that at For Good. So we have a why. It took a long time to get to, and it's a hard process. But I can share that with you later if you want.
Wait, let's introduce the guy, Gareth.
Well, we never do introducing.
Andy, I was wondering if I just slip straight in there.
We hadn't forgotten about you, Andy. Yes.
Andy, so traditionally what happens here is, or what happens in other shows or even platforms, is that people get introduced and there's these long, laborious reading of a profile. We don't do that here on Future CEOs.
No, please don't.
We want you to introduce yourself and then brag a little. So take 30 seconds, take a minute. Who are you? And tell us some interesting stuff.
Not the kind of guy that brags. I'm just an everyday South African that kind of fell in love with tech at a fairly early age and has just been experimenting with some wildly different career paths and projects and products throughout my entire life. I got two kids. I got a great family. I love tech. I love this country. I've become an increasingly sensitized white guy in this country, which I think is really important.
Absolutely.
I haven't got it right. I probably never will, but it's on the right path. I'm addicted to experiences, whether that's personal, adventurous, or business. And that seems to be how my life shaped up so far.
We like to call you an opposer of convention, a digital native, and challenges everything to create impact.
The digital native is a funny term. But, I mean, when I was growing up, I was showing my kids this the other day. They don't get it. I was trying to show them what a computer looked like in 1987.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it had a green screen. I showed them a picture of King's Quest 1, which is this old game. And they just don't get it because they're sitting on a PS4 Pro in 4K.
And not a Commodore 64. Having to program their own stuff. I remember those days.
I tell people that when I got my first email address, I was like, I think I was 8 or 9 years old. And the only person I could email was my dad, who was sitting next to me, because no one else had email.
So this is a lifelong thing for you. So,
perfect time to start from the very beginning.
It absolutely is. I think that let's start from the beginning in a particular kind of way, which is, you used a word there which was experiment. You've been doing this experimenting with different career paths. What kind of person are you, and how did you then develop into a person that has the confidence to be able to experiment with different career paths? Because not very many people can do that. Not with confidence, anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And I suppose part of being at For Good for the last 3 or 4 years has sensitized me to upbringings quite a lot, especially from a South African context. And I mean, I think having incredibly stable parents kind of just breeds a bit of confidence in you. Growing up extremely privileged breeds confidence in a person. I mean, by the time I hit matric, I'd been overseas twice with my school, once on an exchange program and once on a hockey tour. And just so many kids don't get that. In a lifetime, exactly.
I'm going to jump in here, because I would think that sometimes the converse also happens, the opposite happens, which is that you grow up sheltered and privileged, and that actually pulls you away from reality, and then you enter the real world, and it's just it's a ton of bricks that hits you, and you don't really know how to recover from that. So I hear what you're saying, and I appreciate what you're saying, but there's something more. There's something inside of you that has brought you to a point where you have been doing what you're doing, and you're now a CEO, because not everyone is that.
Yeah, it's quite hard to self-diagnose often. But I can't think of anything besides just a fairly stable upbringing, and I just had the space. You know, here's a cool story. So I went to UCT, again, privileged enough to go there. Worked hard, got a bit of an academic scholarship, which helped with fees. But you know, a lot of it was just being right place, right time. So I started off in a law degree. It was a BALLB. We were the guinea pig year of when they introduced streams to UCT. And I'd done all this career counseling at school, and I was like, right, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'd seen LA Law on TV, and this was just like, this was like pre-suits.
That's the stuff that pulled us in that direction.
Exactly. This is the good stuff. So I arrive at varsity, and I was going to do a BA with a whole bunch of subjects to get a general education and go into LLB. Then they had these streams, and they were like, no, you have to choose exactly what you want to be from day one, which threw me completely. So I said, okay, fine, law. So I started in this BALLB 5-year accelerated stream. 6 months later, I was like, law is for the birds. it was nothing like it was on TV. And I switched to BA media, and one of the fascinating things, which you only realize in hindsight, was I only went to varsities on varsity on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Oh, wow.
BA was pretty easy. It was a lot of, you know, philosophy 109, which is write essays and, you know, smoke stuff.
What people aren't seeing is Annie's body language here, which suddenly got a little bit more fluid. So can we safely assume that you wrote essays and did stuff or smoked
stuff?
But
here's kind of the point of the anecdote, is that going to varsity on Tuesday and Thursdays gave me an enormous amount of free time. And I just started filling it with stuff. So one of the first things I filled it with was campus radio, so UCT radio. I was the advertising manager. I had a primetime show. And I just started experimenting there. You know, we streamed UCT radio into this pub called Barney's, which was down there.
Barney's, yeah.
By streamed, I mean we took a tuner and plugged it into their PA so that they could play the Dan Nichols show every day between 2 and 4. And then in about second year or so, or the end of first year, I started a business just because I had this time, I had this space. And I think that's probably one of the most exciting things growing up, is that I've just always had a bit of time and a bit of space, which has allowed me to try these interesting things.
A friend of mine once said, once was talking to a mentor of his, and the mentor said to him, "You're never going to be rich," because this was a few years ago. My friend was an aspiring wealth creator and said, "You're never going to be rich." And he said, "Why? I mean, I'm putting my heart and soul into this." And he said, "It's because you're too busy. You don't have the time." And so time is such an important part of all of this.
I'm so busy, but I still want to be rich. So is it never going to happen?
Well, it's about what you do with your time.
Correct.
And so let's throw this back to Andy. You were able to start some of these things, have the confidence and courage to do many things that others wouldn't do.
Correct.
Why is that? Where did that come from?
I don't know. Maybe just insanely competitive as a person. So losing sucks, and I just never wanted to do it. Maybe that comes from an all-boys school. It's a hell of an interesting argument these days about where you put your kids in single-sex schools or mixed-sex schools, because there are pros and cons either way. And I went to the school which was all about, you know, if you didn't win, you got chewed up and spat out. It's the school that everyone tells you they're at, which I try desperately not to do.
I knew it.
See, I did avoid telling you.
You did it. You went all that way and then clearly busted you, I think.
It's an incredible school.
It is an incredible school. Yeah. You know, let's not at all put it down. But Andy,
but what you got there, though, was competitiveness.
Listen, exactly, and work ethic, you know, and working smart. You know, you can go to school and learn the context, but it's about... And I went to Rustenburg High School, and I found the same with Sachs. I mean, those kind of schools, yes, we weren't bishops, but it's about how they train your mind to work and work hard and yet work hard, work smart. But yet, I think at that point in my life, I wasn't really entrepreneurially savvy. And I think
some, who is though?
I know, but I think sometimes it comes to people earlier on than others. Where did you find that within yourself, Andy?
Yeah,
you or see, do you, or are you?
I'm not even sure I am. When I tell these stories, I think I fell into entrepreneurship accidentally and kind of kicked and screamed against it for almost 20 years.
I love that. I love that.
And it was kind of after that radio station. So I remember this like it was yesterday. The station manager and I, we were having beers and we said, you know these notice boards at Varsity? And again, I'm showing my age here. Because we had pigeonholes as well where you get to store stuff. But like, can't that be done by this thing called the internet? And so we did this whole business plan and scope for what was essentially moving student notice boards online with a whole bunch of interesting stuff. And, you know, started doing our research and found that one actually already existed. And it was this company called GetAlife, gal.co.za, which was an incredibly popular portal, but way back in 1999 onwards. Mm. So I reached out to the guy. It was launched by a guy called John Kuhn, who was at Wits. And incidentally, Gareth Cliff was an early investor, and he was very involved with that project. This kind of really goes way, way back. And by accident, I don't know, I was cocky. You know, maybe that comes from the bishops. And I said, well, listen, you know, I can compete with you, or we can just join up and do this together. And to his credit, John said, sure. So in order to prove myself, I launched GalCape, .co.za. And that's it, you know, falling into tech, falling into business. Before I knew it, you know, in final year, five students were doing their theses on this company.
Wow.
My thesis was this company. We had 30 people, mostly paid with beer. a couple paid with real money.
That's startup life, right?
That is.
Trade, absolutely.
And I ran that thing till 2004, I think. And we peaked at 1.2 million page impressions a month.
Mm.
If you go back to 1999,
absolutely.
So that was probably, say, 2003. That was an insane amount of traffic. I mean,
it's an insane amount of traffic, but I guess some might argue, well, look, maybe the barriers to entry were higher at that point because it wasn't so, certainly the knowledge wasn't all pervading, but also it feels like there were only a handful of sites on the internet. Thank heavens at that point. Now it's all over the place. Let's pull that into then the For Good thing for a moment. Let's just reflect on For Good. For Good, how have you differentiated there? Because you're the CEO, you're running this platform. Just talk to us a little bit about how you've actually got it to move in a particular direction amongst so much.
Yeah, I think the trick with For Good might come a bit in the origin story as well, or at least how I got involved. And this has been a pattern that I've noticed in my life is I seem to be better at taking someone else's idea, polishing it up and kind of getting it to work.
Mm.
I have done a startup with my own idea, which we can chat about. It's great. It was a wine startup and a beer startup. Mm. And that did some amazing things, but ultimately failed. And so For Good was not my idea. It was the idea of a guy called Garth Jaffet, who's very well known in the social sector. He was the...
And Garth's been here on the show, and we've spent some time with him. Phenomenal
great.
Human being.
Yeah. Founder of Soul City, yep. Founder of Heartlines.
Amazing.
Yeah, he's an incredible guy. He's everything except a technologist.
Mm.
And Garth and I met, I sit on the board of a nonprofit called the Witkoppen Health and Medical Center. This is amazing primary healthcare NGO down on William Nicol.
Mm.
And so we met on that board, and he always tells the story, he was bored in a board meeting, and he Googled me. And previously, I was kind of between things at that stage, and I'd written this post about how it really pissed me off that you had to be rich to be philanthropic.
Mm.
That the world was just structured in this way that you couldn't do something good unless you made enormous sacrifices, usually in terms of capital and wealth creation.
Mm.
And I didn't think that that was fair, and I didn't think that that was right.
Neither do I.
And slowly we're being proved right.
Yeah.
And so Garth read this and he thought, okay, look, here's a tech guy who's a rampant capitalist that might have a social bone in his body.
Mm.
And we became friends. And so we kind of gave For Good another shot. For Good has actually been around since 2008.
Oh, really?
It was just way ahead of its time.
Oh, really?
Way, way, way ahead of its time. Yeah. And so November 2014, we kind of joined up. And then we tried to learn from the past, and then we treated it like a new company.
Mm.
And I think one of the most important things we did to get back to your original idea of how you take companies in certain directions and how you carve out a piece of the world is that I didn't want to run a nonprofit. I'm not that kind of guy. Mm. But I wanted to do something meaningful. I wanted to experiment with a meaningful job as opposed to a lot of tech, which is just conversion rates and selling wine and selling beer and those kind of things. Yeah. And so we built a social impact company that actually had a business model.
I'm liking this a lot.
Which 3.5 years ago was rare. It's changing, and that's really exciting to see. And so we had this thing, and the way we frame it is that we try to give 50% social returns and 50% capital returns. And you'll never actually achieve that, but the tension that it creates makes for some really interesting decisions.
Mm. Yeah, and some increasingly interesting innovations in the
absolutely.
Space.
I mean,
absolutely. And just to this point, I think too many people think that innovation or creation, the creative process, happens in a quiet room somewhere, but actually it's a very tension-filled process, and that's what you're highlighting.
Yeah, completely. That was kind of the positioning. So when we launched it, it was this volunteering platform that was free, and it got charities involved and volunteers and all this kind of thing. But behind the scenes, we had started already before it was even developed, as with most dazzling startups. We'd started selling it to Corporate South Africa as a solution for their employee volunteering. So now that takes you straight back into very typical business speak, which is it's a SaaS company, software as a service. It's a B2B company, which typically in South Africa is a much safer bet than a B2C company. Mm. And so while this public brand was growing and we were trying to ride this crest of goodwill and people wanting to become more socially conscious but not knowing where to start, we were hammering and pounding the pavement trying to sell, trying to flog this to corporates as a tool, as a software tool. That, I think, is what got it to where it is now. It gave it that edge that's allowed it to survive for the last 3.5 years.
What has been the most difficult time out of, from the initial startup that you created in For Good? What has been the toughest lesson learned?
Sure.
Seems like there've been plenty.
Yeah, I mean, every business has a different lesson, which is I suppose what's so fascinating about these experiments. I think with For Good, and I have this argument with a lot of people, especially in the social sector. They disagree with me wholeheartedly, but I think I'm right. So I think we're selling something that people want but don't need. And when you think of who our target customer is, that's corporate South Africa. Now, I'm going to put a disclaimer, is that the 13 corporates we already work with are incredible. They're brave. They're pioneering. They've put their money where their mouth is, and they're trying to do something which is just completely underdeveloped in the developing world, this culture of volunteering, which is shocking considering the developing
Correct.
World is where we need it the most.
Correct. Like you so much, yeah.
So they're disclaimed against because I think, not only did they bite at our pitch, but they are trying to do something different. Mm. But for the rest of the companies that we've pitched to, and I ran the numbers the other day, it's quite frightening. This is for all the budding entrepreneurs that listen to your show, how many no's you actually get.
We know that story. Yeah, so and don't take it personally. That's what I've learned about it.
Yeah.
Correct?
We've pitched 198 companies.
Oh, wow.
We've pretty much gone from the JSE top to bottom, of which we've had 13, hopefully soon 14, say yes, and a couple of them are now with us for 2-3 years. And I think the reason so many of them said no is that social impact, CSI, volunteering, employee engagement, while it sounds like the recipe for modern success, putting purpose alongside profit, and that's part of our pitch. Companies want it, but they don't need it. Mm. While the existing capitalist system of returning value to shareholders still exists, this tension is never going to be broken. Mm. And realizing that was going to make this thing even harder was possibly the toughest lesson that we still learn every day.
I'm interested in this pitching journey because, and I want to continue to talk to those entrepreneurs that are in that phase of, and we'll go into that phase again and again and again. And
yeah, you're never really out of it, are you?
Yeah,
you're always pitching.
You're always selling, you're always pitching.
Absolutely.
At what point did you begin to find success? So how many pitches did you have to go through, and what did you have to do in order to iterate or change, develop that pitch in order to actually be heard? Just talk about that, not the detail of it, but rather just the journey of it.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of early success from a sales point of view. Couple of big name brands that came on board, and I would say that was largely just through networks. Mm. You know, if I've learned anything over the last 20 years of playing in the space, it's the networks are just so powerful.
Are they really, Andy?
Yeah, I know. But no one will tell you how to build one, and building one's actually quite hard.
you know, and one of the questions that we like throwing out to our guests is that, you know, what are the measures through the journey of success? Is it the connections that you have through your networks, or is it your typical skill set that you have as a business or as an individual? And people always say it's a merge of both. And people always say that your network is your net worth.
Yeah. And I would add one thing to that. It's any kind of success, however temporary or sustainable, is network and just sheer grit. Mm. You know, that's where most people fall down, I think, in this whole entrepreneurial journey is, you know, pitching to 198 people and just getting turned down again and again and again. You know, on average, it takes me 4 or 5 emails just to get a response from a person within a corporate space.
Absolutely.
And that's just the hustle of the game. So I think we had some early success due to networks, and then it was just sheer grit and slowly starting to learn that often what you're selling is not quite what they want to buy.
Yeah. And I think this is my point. So what often happens is that the phrase is you stare at your own navel. And really what you are doing is you're so convinced that the words that you're saying are what they're hearing and what they're wanting that you're blind to the fact that they actually want something else.
Yeah, totally. What did we learn? CSI teams, who mostly we pitch to, we should be pitching to a combination of CSI and HR, because one of the exciting things about volunteering is that this is engagement. This is how you allow people to grow within an organization. But in South Africa, we're so far behind the curve that out of 198 companies, we've had HR in the room twice.
Oh, wow.
So the gap, you know, and I really feel for CSI teams, because CSI sometimes, and especially in corporate South Africa, is a team of one, maybe two, dealing with a publicly listed company with billions of rands. They're kind of shucked off into a corner, told to spend 1% net profit after tax, take some nice pictures. That sounds cynical.
It's the truth. I believe you.
There's a lot of that goes on.
And I believe you.
And so understanding that and empathizing with these teams and then figuring out that one of their biggest challenges in the CSI space is that they are enormously purposeful people that want to make a difference, and they have the financial firepower to do it, but they're completely under-resourced, they're given very little budget, and they're asked to do things that they just don't have the teams to execute on most of the time.
And you also need, as I read through your paper, I'm not going to pretend that it sounds for me, that the executives need to have the buy-in as well. You want the CEOs to show that charge and to show that chase and to show that leadership.
Yeah, but I mean, here's the cold slap of reality, is you're not going to get a meeting with a CEO about an employee volunteering program.
Yeah. Mm.
You've got to go in at CSI and hope that somehow the CEO picks up on this, supports it strategically. You don't go in at that level. We've made that mistake before, just going in too senior. You actually have to go in with the team that's responsible for it, and it has to be on their scorecards. They have to be incentivized to roll this out, or it just meanders. Mm. I think everyone says understanding your target market. It sounds so cheesy, but you do. And the more you pitch and the more they say no, the more you learn about those little levers that you have to pull. Mm. You know, one of the biggest levers for us is understanding the purpose-driven nature of CSI people, understanding they have no time, and pitching for good as this tool that means they don't have to run around after employees, finding them places to volunteer. And it sounds so simple, but that's often what gets that first set of interest going.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just think about how many times, and I mean, we've sat through, Luby and I certainly have been invited and sat through a number of different pitching competitions and opportunities, and how often people miss the mark. And so go out and test. I think that's the lesson here. Go out and test, and sometimes the test is a trial by fire in front of a client, and they're going to say, no, 100 and...
So cool. What's 198 minus 13? Maths isn't great. Yeah.
That many times. Andy, let's go back into your journey.
Yeah.
So you hit this point where you are now developing websites. There's an evolution again. Talk to us about this next evolution.
Yeah. So, I think one of the most life-shaping experiences happened near the end of Get a Life, because the original founder, this guy called John Kuhn, he died. He was 24.
Oh wow!
So he was doing a Rhodes scholarship. I think he was just out of it. That's kind of the last couple of years where I'd taken over the company entirely. That's the kind of guy he was. Like the fact that he got a Rhodes scholarship, he was incredible. President of the SRC at Wits, etc., etc. And he had a heart condition that most people didn't know about.
Wow.
And one day he just died. And I learned one of the hardest lessons ever, in fact a whole slew of lessons about how to let go and how hard you have to fight for certain things, but one of the more interesting ones was just how important getting your legal stuff right is. And so we were students, you know, we hadn't done the legal stuff right, and so that entire company got sucked into his estate. And if you've ever gone through any kind of estate planning or estate management, you know that pretty much that freezes everything.
Yeah.
And I fought tooth and nail to keep this thing alive for a year and a half, dealing with his family who was grieving and not particularly interested in how this thing was running, but more extracting whatever value there was left as a reminder of their son. And it was just this torrid emotional time. And eventually I just had to walk away. You know, it just got to a point where it didn't work. And unfortunately, because I was so involved, most of the people walked with me. And you know, the best thing to come out of it was John's mom set up a foundation for kids. Mm-hmm. So while that thing was still making money, which was for a surprisingly long time, all that money went into this foundation for getting kids through university. And that was kind of an ending to a very sad story. But
well, what's interesting about it is that it's almost a forced ending, which often people don't have to experience. It's not something that you're driven into. In this particular case, you're driven that direction. You're a smart individual, though. At what point are you looking around and saying, okay, this is dying. I can see it's moving away from where we wanted it to go. I have to move on.
You know, I think like realistically that happens when you realize you've lost control. And you might have actually lost control 6 months prior
long
to that.
But the realization only hits you.
Exactly. And it was something I went through again with the second startup, which probably should have ended sooner than it did. It's the slow death. And it's one of the biggest pieces of advice I think I have for anyone is that if you're going to die fast.
Absolutely. so you can recover.
So you can recover and try again.
And succession planning, what would you say to entrepreneurs about that in their businesses, Andy?
To be honest, I haven't even thought of it. To be brutally honest, I got it wrong at Gal. I thought this was what I was doing. You know, we were building this empire, and so I hadn't even thought. John hadn't thought of succession planning. Maybe I was his succession plan. That could have been that. And it's just actually never come up. It's something I'm finally starting to confront it at for good, I suppose. Is that what is, you know, how do I, you know, I don't think I'm going to be CEO forever. I think I want a young black South African to head up this company. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that is a really interesting way to end a chapter. Bearing in mind, we have a long, long way to go. And I've got to find this person and I want to train them. And there's a lot I still want to do. But that's as close as I've come to succession planning.
As CEO at For Good, what are your daily priorities? What do you have to do now? Will you wake up and do what?
Sure. I mean,
tell us your day.
Isn't that the cool thing about entrepreneurship? Is it's different every
single
day.
Absolutely. Every moment. Yes. Tell us about your day.
The only thing that's the same every day, I suppose, is a rampant and OCD practice of inbox zero. It's just trying to stay on top of that. Because I have I have friends who have 18,000 unread emails in their inbox.
God.
And yeah, I don't know how they're still.
I don't know how they're still alive.
Existing.
Yeah.
So you know, very much OCD keeping on top of that, but it really does change. And I think the role of a CEO is to kind of dip in where necessary and not too much.
No micromanagement stuff.
Exactly. If you don't let your people and your team do it themselves, A, they're never going to learn, but B, you're going to constantly get this repeating cycle of your decisions and what it is you want.
Absolutely.
The whole thing about scaling. The whole thing about scaling is different perspectives and then trying to remove barriers. Maybe that's a good description of like anyone who's in charge of something. That's your job, is to remove barriers.
Love that.
But you did introduce it at a particular point in your leadership journey, in the business's journey, which is that's really at the point of scale. Prior to that, you are pulling in team members who may be technically sound, who don't always see what you're seeing, and so you're talking about a point of scale. So I'm just talking to any entrepreneur out there who thinks, okay, now I'm going to start releasing, but actually it's an inappropriate time to do it.
Good point. And I think, you know, even more important to say that the hustle of these kind of things, and you know, we think of Forgood as being 3.5-4 years old. There's still an enormous amount of stuff that I do myself,
of course,
because it's part of the hustle.
Of course,
I still email every single client that we pitch to. I still am involved in almost every single pitch. That's the hustle of it. I'm still doing product design. I'm sitting with our dev team debugging. I'm logging tickets. I'm doing data capturing every now and again when we have a crisis. I'm doing training. There is still an enormous amount of hustle. But it was, I think it's something in any kind of person's leadership journey. And the word CEO can actually be a bit misleading, because it sometimes makes you sound enormously senior when that's not always the case. The CEO of a listed company, the CEO of a 50 to 100 million rand company, and the CEO of an SME can often be very, very different people. But I think I eventually in that journey did realize that you just can't scale yourself. You know, this comes from a guy who ran my second startup was Real Time Wine and My Beer, and I ran that by myself. So, you know, it might sound all wise now, but I only know this because I've screwed it up before. I just couldn't scale myself. And it was one of the first things we did at Forgood, was just set about building a cracker team. It's a small team. It's 8 people. But that's 800% more than I could be doing. Possibly 1,000% more than I.
What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses as a leader or as a business person?
There's a fascinating, what do you call it? Like an HR test called the Gallup strengths.
The Gallup strengths.
I don't know if you've come across them.
Yeah, I know Gallup, yeah.
And what I really like about them is that a lot of these personality or skills-based tests kind of identify the type of person that you are and then help you focus on correcting weaknesses. Whereas Gallup is very opposite to that, and that identifies your strengths and says, don't worry about your weaknesses.
Focus on this.
Focus on your strengths. You're good at it. So my Gallup strengths are quite funny. It's very much kind of I break the scale on extrovert. So it's all about communication, and sounds a bit cheesy, but one of the Gallup strengths is woo.
Woo.
Woo. Like that.
Which is your ability to kind of to
like
communicate
that.
And charm and
like that a lot.
And build relationships.
Like that a lot.
And I think that's probably what I'm best at, is not being a dick. As an overriding
number one, don't be a dick.
Thank you, Gallup.
And just building these relationships and actually caring about the people that work in our team.
And what kind of people do you look for to work with?
Well, and I want to add to this question is how do you find them? Because there's going to be so many people out there that are trying to scale, trying to expand teams. How the heck do you find them?
And what do you look for?
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything more frustrating in South Africa at the moment, it's that people think we have a job shortage, but we don't. We have a skills shortage. It's right back to the whole education thing. I'll give you my best hack, and we'll see where that goes.
Perfect.
One of the curses of hiring is the spray and pray approach used by people.
What is that?
So LinkedIn, Biz Community, all these kind of portals where you advertise, they've made it so easy to apply, one-click apply with your preordained CV, that people don't actually pay attention to the specs anymore, which means now the burden is on you as the employer to go and filter through hundreds, sometimes thousands of CVs. So we invented this little hack, and it's worked a charm, is that at the top of the job spec, we say, please don't just submit your CV, read the job spec. And at the bottom of the job spec, we say, do not submit your CV. Any CVs that are submitted will get ignored. Please answer these 5 questions. And it's frightening. But
how many people?
So our averages for, let's say, a program manager, which is like a junior account manager that wants to like scale up quite quickly in an entrepreneurial environment, you're talking through 2 to 5 years experience, say. We will get 200 to 300 CVs we will get maybe 5 or 6
wow.
that answer the questions. But that filter, you're now dealing with 5 or 6 exceptional people who've actually put some effort into this and kind of know that they want you as much as you need to figure out whether you want them. And that served us really well, especially trying to figure out which questions to ask and then how to interpret the answers.
I love it. Often these recruitment processes, there are kill questions that people put there, but this is not a kill question. This is pre-question. This is actually seeing, do you read? Can you see detail?
Comprehension. Fantastic.
Yeah, nice. just giving a damn about the process.
To your one click.
And so I think that's helped. But you know, that said, it's frighteningly hard to hire and find good people, and not only find good people. And here again, I think we have this difference between being a CEO of an SME versus the CEO of a listed company. Is that at some stage you get to scale where one person leaving hurts but doesn't break. For the majority of businesses in this country that are in the, say, 0 to even 20 million turnover a year, I think the gap really is that big. You are so reliant on your team, especially the team that sticks around, that when one of them leaves, it breaks things. And as the CEO, that's now on you to dive back in there and try and build it up again.
With everything that you're doing, do you make time for a good book, or how do you self-educate? How do you self-improve? How do you upskill yourself, Andy, as skilled and as knowledgeable and as educated as you already are? Because I know you always want to improve. You're that kind of person.
I think that's very complimentary.
Yes or no?
Perhaps not true.
Really? What do you do?
So to
stay ahead of your pack.
So it's an interesting question. I battle with online media, news and articles and things like that, because I think the world has just become too distracting. You know, you've got mail notifications, Slack notifications, WhatsApp's buzzing all over the place, tweets, and I just don't find I have the attention span to get through those things. And then also, for some reason, this might be a generational thing, but YouTube just doesn't work for me. I don't know why. I think it's because it's as a digital medium, and it's just too easy to get distracted. I know my kids are growing up in a YouTube generation, and I look forward to them teaching me. But here's the only trick and the only hack that's ever worked for me, and that's podcasts. So I am a rampant, rabid listener of podcasts in the car. I even force my kids to sit through it sometimes. Every single time I'm in the car, there is a podcast playing.
And you're a podcaster, but you also love podcasts.
I've been involved in podcasts. I wouldn't say I founded one. Just haven't had the time. But yeah, I've been on plenty of podcasts, and I love them. But the quality of material that is getting produced nowadays on podcasts, and this on-demand nature of it, that you can listen when you want, you can pause, you can carry on a different device, has just revolutionized. And you know, I look through the subscription list on my phone, and there is some absolutely incredible academic material about business and life.
Very nice, Kluby.
Wrapping it up.
Let's do a quick fire round very quickly our wrap up. So, a book you'd recommend to our future CEOs community. I know you've spoken about podcasts, but just give us a book that has made a real impression.
The Lean Startup. Yeah, I read that about 3/4 of the way through the Real Time Wine journey, and just face palmed for about 3 weeks because
how could I have done that?
I'd committed every sin that book speaks of. And it's that book is all about testing.
It is.
And
quick prototyping, move into the market. Yeah.
It's the recipe for the modern world. You have to read it.
Mm. Okay, so The Lean Startup. The worst advice you've ever received.
Sure.
Worst advice.
It'll all get better.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
It kind of underplays the grit and the hustle that you actually need to get through a lot of this stuff.
Skills or connections when it comes to business success?
Connections.
That's 3, hey? Yeah.
I'm almost sad to say it. It kind of hurts a little because I think skill, you got to be excellent at what you do. But connections is just a game changer. You can learn skills. Connections take time to build.
Attitude or aptitude?
When you're attitude. Hiring.
When you're hiring. Yep. Nice. Attitude or aptitude?
Attitude. So we have a line on our job specs, which have become quite well known. Yeah. The one is university degree required. If you don't have one, tell us why you don't need one.
Mm. Ooh.
Mm. Attitude.
Very nice. Yeah, you're bringing out the gems today, my man. Yeah.
So we have these guests.
I get excited. I tell you. Can you hear me? Yes.
She hasn't been here for a while. So what we do is we have guests that come on and they share gems. So we're going to be quoting you a lot. There are some good stuff.
There's some good stuff, babe.
Okay, so let's wrap it up with this final question, which is if you could go back in time, and we do ask all of our guests this, if you could go back in time and talk to the future CEO, 20-year-old future CEO you, what would you say to yourself? Give yourself one or two pointers.
It's a very Tim Ferriss question of yours. I think I would tell that person that it's okay to experiment. You know, it's fine in hindsight to say I've had this crazy life with all these crazy experiences, moving from, I mean, if it's student media to So let's trace it. Student media to kind of the construction industry to banking to the booze industry
to
social impact. That there's
awesome.
there's no path there.
Awesome.
And it looks fine in hindsight, and it looks like it was all preordained and planned out, but it wasn't. And the kind of stress that experimentation puts on you as you kind of have to toss something away and start something new is a lot. And I would just tell that guy that it's absolutely okay to experiment. The millennials know it, and that's why they act like they act.
Yeah.
They just have this confidence around being able to reinvent themselves that I think the Gen Xers, and I'm on the border between Gen X and millennial. Mm. my young team constantly reminds me of this. Mm. I think we just didn't have that. We were expected to do something and do it well. Mm. The kind of Dr. Lawyer
stick
approach.
To one thing and do it well. Correct.
Experimentation is okay. Yeah. That's the advice I would give a 20-year-old me.
Andy Hadfield, the CEO of For Good. Thank you so very much for your time and for your insights and for sharing so many of your stories.
Wow, connecting people who want to do good to organizations that help that need their help. Let me do that again. Connecting people who want to do good to organizations that need their help. Thank you so much. And it was such a privilege having you in studio. And if you want to listen to that podcast, don't forget to go to Cliff Central or Future CEOs on our website, because he will truly give you pearls of wisdom for your business.
Thank you, Andrew.
Absolute pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.